Hello there, and welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news. A little bit of everything today, including answers to your calls and emails. So, before we go any further, let me welcome you and remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let me just start with raising, I think, what could be a significant issue for many people out there. And that is a study looking at drug combos raising breast cancer risk. And this is for the 500,000 women in the United States who are breast cancer survivors and are taking tamoxifen, a drug which blocks estrogen receptors and reduces the recurrence rate of breast cancer significantly. Now, what we have known about the physiology for a long time, but we really haven't been sure of the implications, has recently turned out to have significant implications. The study, which was announced in May at a cancer conference and has not yet been published in any medical journals, shows that drugs such as Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft, which are in the class of serotonin reuptake inhibitors, because of the way that they are broken down in the body through the liver, interfere with tamoxifen and, in fact, may completely wipe out the benefits of risk reduction. Not all antidepressants do this. This is particularly a factor for the Prozac group, but it is very important for doctors and breast cancer survivors to be aware of this drug interaction and to avoid it. I did have a couple of emails I wanted to share with you. This one from Gilda or Hilda, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, in Santa Cruz. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I was interested in your interview on the 13th about irritable bowel syndrome and other gut-related issues. I've had a history of mild colitis in my life, and I'm always looking for new insights about causes and treatments. I want to share with you and your listeners some incredible results I recently had with a bout of colitis in Chinese medicine. I was experiencing a lot of gas, a profuse amount of mucus that came along with the gas, and a small amount of blood with the mucus in the stools. This is a classic sort of colitis presentation, parenthetically. Although I did receive a couple of acupuncture treatments, I felt that the herbs that were mixed by one of the Chinese doctors at the Five Branches Institute and made into a strong brew taken by me twice daily was what stopped all the symptoms within 2 weeks. Fortunately, it was a relatively mild case of colitis, but I was shocked at how effective the herbs were. I took the herbs for a total of a month and grew to love the taste of that tea because it enabled me to resume good GI health. And so she goes on to talk about her other efforts to reduce her stress and support her body. And I won't belabor those because those are all things we've all heard and pretty much have internalized. But I thought you'd be interested in a testimonial, and that's what it is, N of one, non-scientific, talking about Chinese herbs and colitis. I do think that things that can modulate the immune response in the intestine are a very effective strategy. I'm curious about the particular combination of drugs, but because these treatments are individualized, it's not a one-size-fits-all recipe. And if you do decide to treat your colitis or any other medical issue with alternative measures such as Chinese herbs, I want to emphasize it's extremely important to work with a practitioner who has the appropriate knowledge. This is not try it at home stuff. These are real medications. They aren't pharmaceuticals, but they are real medications and they need to be used properly. I saw this news clip. This came out very, very recently on the Associated Press, I think. And the headline was, "Obesity during early childhood raises the chances that a person will be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer." I'm going to just spend a few moments deconstructing the study with a critique of the newspapers, the critique of the people who write these press releases, and also kind of just a little statistics 101 spin commentary. We haven't done that for a while. Here are the lines that I'm taking issue with. Research has found that obese youths between the ages of 14 and 19 had a 60% higher chance of developing pancreatic cancer than their less overweight peers. Next paragraph, obese individuals between the ages of 20 and 40 were 2 to 3 times more likely to develop pancreatic cancer, but the risk leveled off for those who gained their weight in their 40s and was statistically insignificant for those 50 or above. Now, a 60% higher chance versus 2 to 3 times more likely are not the same way of expressing the information. And unless a person's fairly sophisticated, they might not understand which risk was higher. They might think that the 60% risk was greater than 2 to 3 times more likely. These numbers should be expressed in something called a relative risk ratio. And a relative risk is where you give the population risk is always 1.0. And so a 60% higher chance of developing pancreatic cancer would be a relative risk of 1.6. A 2 to 3 times more likely would be a relative risk of 2 to 3. Well, you could say that 2 to 3 times more likely was a 200% increase. And you would. You'd say 200 or to 300% increase if you were seeking to emotionally exaggerate the significance to the reader. And you would use the 2 to 3 times more likely or twice as likely kind of seems to minimize it a little bit in my view. But the problem with this, as well as many of the studies that are published and framed as great news, is that you don't have a sense for the absolute magnitude of the risk. And that's a really important thing. Let's say, for example, that the likelihood of having pancreatic cancer between the ages of 14 and 19, the probability of having pancreatic cancer is probably something along the lines of 1 in 100,000. That is my just pulling a number out of the air. But it's not a big risk, is my point. This is a very rare cancer in that age group. So a 60% increased chance of an extremely rare event is still not particularly meaningful or newsworthy. So if they actually gave us the absolute risk or the absolute ratio, in other words, 1.6 over 100,000, you wouldn't care that much. You simply wouldn't care. But instead, what we have is a risk that is not framed that way. It's framed in a way that makes it sound like news. And this level of lack of sophistication really bothers me sometimes. And I want to frame another one here. This was from the Washington Post. It's about 2 weeks old. Study shows possible links between deaths and ADHD drugs. All right, so what we're talking about is children who take Ritalin, who take Adderall, who take other stimulant medications for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And we've talked before on this program about how that number is rising, perhaps a little too quickly. But that's a philosophical issue and a social discussion. On the other hand, when we talk about the issues of children dying of sudden death, that's really, really, really rare. And so it doesn't surprise me that because this is a cardiac stimulant, a child dying of cardiac sudden death has something intrinsically wrong with their heart. That's just not a natural thing. There is a short circuit in that heart. And yeah, if you have a short circuit in a system and you give a stimulant medication, you're going to increase the odds. But, you know, I have to come down on the side of sensibility here. I have to come down on the drug side. If you have a child who has severe ADHD, you're in hell. That child is in hell when they're in school. And it is appropriate to treat. And the treatment should include behavioral management. The drugs should be used minimally, but they can make a huge difference in everyone's quality of life. So they shouldn't be dismissed or demonized. On the other hand, they shouldn't be given to any child with minor behavioral problems so that they shut up and sit still. That's not an appropriate use of the medication. Looking at the absolute raw numbers, there are 500 children in the United States between 1985 and 1996 who had a sudden inexplicable death. And of these children, they were matched with another child of similar age, sex, and other variables who died in a traffic accident. Because the researchers had this premise, taking a stimulant drug is unlikely to have played any role in a child getting killed in an accident. I don't know that I buy that basic assumption because, for one thing, children with ADHD probably are more likely to get killed in traffic accidents because they have judgment and impulse control issues as well. But no one's ever done that study. Anyway, 10 children in the group that had suffered sudden unexplained death had been taking stimulant drugs, whereas only 2 children in the group killed in traffic accidents were taking such medication. So of the 564 children who had sudden death, 10 were taking stimulant drugs. And even though that's twice as much as the other people, it's still not a big enough number for me to feel like it's news. And I just wonder where the editorial boards are going with these news stories. And, you know, they could dedicate that space to educating people about treatment options for a disease. They could dedicate those pages to talking about appropriate healthcare behaviors or discussing the evidence that something like high fructose corn syrup might be adverse to your health under any circumstances and should be minimized in the diet. But rather than doing that, they do these sort of, as if it were important, kind of pseudoscience stories that I almost feel like they're pandering to, well, it's a little bit like the infidelity stuff. Sorry to digress, but is that really news? Does that really need to be on the front page of the San Jose Mercury News 2 days running? I so don't care where someone's genitals were. This is a person who's in government. I care whether they're doing their job. I really don't care if they're having an affair. That's really their business. There's so much else going on. We passed, for goodness sakes, clean air thing last night. That wasn't on the front page. The priorities are screwed up. Let's try to clarify priorities. Let's demand, in fact, that our news media clarify priorities. We had an off-air comment from a caller about the colitis email. I had ulcerative colitis and was told I'd be on acecal, mesalamine, for the rest of my life. I took probiotics instead, and I feel fine. So let me just emphasize, if you go back to the archives and ask Dr. Dawn and look at June 13th, there is a very good interview talking about the use of probiotics as well as natural compounds like boswellia and curcumin for maintaining remission in ulcerative colitis. There is good, hard scientific data that these things work, particularly in ulcerative colitis. The data in Crohn's disease is not as strong. And we are ignoring this very useful information. Drugs like mesalamine, which are anti-inflammatories, they're non-absorbed, heavy anti-inflammatory drugs, are very effective. And they're what I use when I need to get someone into remission. When I need to get someone into remission, I'll use whatever it takes, and that includes steroids. But I want to keep that person in remission. And the appropriate approach is to find out if that person has food sensitivities, because those will flare the immune system. Absolutely seed their gut with probiotics, because the probiotic biofilm that forms has substances in it that modulate the immune response, that make your immune system work better. So it's in the archives, and I would urge anyone who has colitis and has been given a similar commentary, you'll have to be on mesalamine for the rest of your life, to take that as a big fat maybe. That's what your doctor knows about, and that's what your doctor has to tell you, because that's the standard of care in our culture. And when you go away from the standard of care, you are taking a very, very big risk. Now, I just dissed the Mercury News. I'm going to go ahead and compliment them for another story that they had on their front page this week. And that was June 23rd's issue, talking about research done at Stanford Hospital analyzing hospital noise. And this has been one of my pet peeves for a very long time. And I would certainly invite commentary from the listeners about their experience in the hospital. But as a physician, I am really frustrated with all of the noise pollution that exists in the hospitals where I round. It's so important when you're sick, recovering from surgery or suffering from an infection, to have a low stress level, to be nurtured and cosseted and kept warm and kept in a little cocoon. And in hospitals, we have ignored that patient need, I think, to an absurd degree. And a lot of that has to do with a failure of centralized vision. And a lot of it has to do with regulations that need to be revamped, have gotten in the way. So, for example, there are laws that say that cardiac monitors have to make a lot of noise. And the oxygen monitors that are all available commercially have a loud alarm signal that goes off that is designed to be heard down the hall. The problem is, if you're the patient stuck in bed, you're not down the hall, you're right next to it. And the researchers at Stanford were able to show that the sounds in the rooms actually exceed the EPA guidelines for long-term sound exposure, for industrial sound exposure. That's crazy. So give me a call. Tell me about your experience in the hospital. Did you have a nice quiet time? Did you experience noise pollution? Do you think this is a meaningful issue that we need to address? And let's talk about test results. Now, we started off earlier talking about statistical outliers and the fact that information isn't presented very well. Another pet peeve I have is the way information is presented on test results. So it started out as a good idea. Probably sometime in the 70s, it was certainly before I was practicing medicine, because at the very beginning I would see this, when a patient's test results came back, next to it on that same line with the actual potassium or sodium or chloride would be something called the reference range. And this would be the quote-unquote normal range, although it's not really normal. Then after a year or so, they started putting a little flag like a star or an H or an L next to the level, so that if your sodium was 133, for example, and the reference range was 135 to 150, then there would be an L to kind of flag it so the doctor would think about that number. All very good so far. The problem is that reference range represents the range of 95% of the tests done that you would expect to be normal, which means that by definition, 5% are not going to be normal, although they may not indicate a condition that is of clinical significance or that is unhealthy. This continues to be a huge frustration to me, and the reason I'm framing this is this ABC News from June 23rd was patients often not told about abnormal test results. And this pings on our discussion of statistics. Study finds communication breakdowns at least 7% of the time. And the story is 7% of the time patients with abnormal test results, that's 135 out of 1,889 abnormal results, the patient was either not informed of the test result or the facility had not documented having communicated with the patients about the result. Give me strength on the document every communication that you have with a patient requirement. That is insane and will create an enormous amount of waste. Documentation needs to be more selective, not more inclusive. But coming back to the idea, so communication breakdowns at least 7% of the time. 7% is often not told about abnormal test results. I'm sorry, 93% of the time the patients were told about abnormal test results. So most often, way most often, they were told. I don't think that the headline matches the data. And I have to tell you, as a physician, because of this clinical significance, is that number, is that low or is that high clinically significant? Does it mean anything, or is it just a statistical outlier that I should ignore? And I have to tell you, if I give the patients their lab form and they've had, let's say, 20 tests, it's virtually a statistical certainty that there will be at least one H or one L on those test results. So in a standard physical, I almost never have a person get all of the labs on their standard physical come back without at least one flag. And every time I just send the results to a person and write on them normal, then I often, way often, get a call back saying, "It's not normal, doctor. There's an L here. What does that mean?" And, you know, the answer is it doesn't mean anything. It's a statistical outlier. And I do get extremely frustrated with the no-win situation. People have a right to their test results, but they also need to trust that if the doctor has written normal and signed it, then that means that those H's and those L's are appropriately ignored. And what I would ask of patients is that they please demand your test results. But then if your doctor gives you the statement that these are fine, don't argue with them. Don't ask for a prolonged explanation of your MCV or your MCH. It's not a useful exercise, and it really creates an incentive for the doctor not to give you your test results at all, because they don't want to have that discussion with everybody because it's a waste of their time. And all doctors have to sell is either time or procedures. And if we're going to ask doctors to spend more time with patients versus doing less procedures, I'd like to make it quality time. Let's go to our first caller. It is Nancy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Dawn. I enjoy listening to your program. I want to just agree with you completely on the question of noise in hospitals. I had a 8-day stay in a local hospital and then a 4-day stay at a rehab facility, and both were just enormously difficult to rest. In fact, in the rehab facility, there was this beeping noise that goes on, I guess, when people hit their beeper and ask for their nurse, and it sounded like it was right outside my door, and I couldn't sleep. It just kept waking me up. It was the most awful thing. So I'm completely in agreement with you, and there should be something done to really minimize the amount of noise that happens in an attempted healing situation.
I think that our best solution is to go to the hospital authorities and have them change the regulations, because to a certain extent, as far as the monitors are concerned at this point, the hospital's hands are tied. I'd rather have a strobe going off at the nurse's station, or a bright blinking light, since everybody's got computer screens nowadays, a click-through, so that if you're nurse so-and-so, the computer knows who your patients are. And so in order for you to do anything on your computer screen, including document all the stuff that you're required to document, which is a serious burden on healthcare that needs to be looked at as well. But as far as documentation is concerned, you can't document anything until you click through a thing saying 143 is summoning you. And yeah, you may have to do what you're doing first, but you have to click through that. Just like when you log onto a website, you have to click through the license agreement in order to get to the website. Yeah. And those sort of things could be built into electronic medical records. It would serve as a pester, as a tickler, whatever you want to call it, a reminder that you have a patient who needs you, but it wouldn't mean that the patient in 142 and 144 have to listen to 143's buzzer for that 10 minutes that it's on.
Yes.
This is nuts.
And yes, I agree with you completely.
A few years ago, I was on the board of directors of Dominican Hospital, and that was a really wonderful experience. I'm extremely grateful for the education I received, and it gave me quite an interesting perspective. And one of the things that, even then, I was trying to crusade for getting earplugs in the hospital. And the first response, you know, typical bureaucratic response, was, well, what about the liability? And I'm like, liability? Foam earplugs? Excuse me? Could you clarify that, please? And the liability would be, well, what if someone went home with the earplugs in and they got an ear infection? You know, they could sue us. I thought for a minute and I took a deep breath and I said, you have a point. The lawyers will probably fight us on the earplugs. And we eventually did get some carpeting in the hallways, which helped quite a lot. And now they do have earplugs at Dominican Hospital. They're bright red, and they're connected to each other by a little blue cord, which I guess is, again, for the liability issue. You can find them in the dark. They aren't going to, you know, wander into some orifice somewhere, I guess. That was felt to be safer. They do help, I have to say. They do help. It takes a long time to make a change in an institution, and we're at a moment of great flux in terms of what is going on in healthcare, and I'd like to see some sort of targeted regulatory relief. I think that could be really interesting and really effective. Mm-hmm. So maybe writing to your congressman. Hopefully you're sending a letter to your congressman and also sending a letter to your Aunt Susie in Virginia's congressman, or getting your Aunt Susie to send the letter, that, you know, we need single payer, we need rational healthcare reform, we need a national set of standards of care. Because if we have national standards of care, we get rid of a lot of defensive medicine and a lot of CYA behavior. Mm-hmm. If we make people have to justify doing more rather than justifying doing less, we'd be in a much better position as far as our cost controls are concerned. And it doesn't mean we have to necessarily do less, but again, a lot of the costs in our system are due to our doing too much of the wrong stuff and not approaching things in a more rational fashion because of the market forces at work. In a single-payer situation, the market forces at work go away, and that's where they need to be. Sorry to get on the soapbox, but they need to be away, because mm-hmm. this is the sort of change that should be a no-brainer.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. interesting email here from Kimberly in San Francisco. Dear Dr. Don, at the onset of ovulation, I am unable to eat for 3 days without experiencing severe bowel spasms with the presence of undigested food in my GI tract. The pain subsides when my GI tract is emptied. Antispasmodic and synthetic hormones have not worked. Starvation for 3 days works. Would you suggest probiotics or any other homeopathic remedies? Kimberly, I found your correlation of your symptoms with your ovulation very intriguing, and I was curious how you were establishing that you were ovulating. If you're using pain as a indicator of ovulation, then of course the fact that you get pain and then bowel spasms, maybe that pain isn't in fact coming from your ovaries, but is coming from your bowels in the first place. If you're using some other method like cervical mucus, and I'm going to predicate the rest of my answer on the assumption that you are using body temperature rise or cervical mucus or one of the other methods of ovulation timing to make this correlation. So the first question I have is about the idea that nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories are something people often take to treat menstrual cramps and Mittelschmerz, which is ovulation pain. Are you doing that? Because nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories can cause fairly significant gastrointestinal symptoms in people, and presumably you've made that connection and eliminated it, but I wanted to put it out there to be sure that you had. Secondly, I wanted to hypothesize that the hormonal shifts, the LH surge, which occurs and triggers ovulation, luteinizing hormone or LH being secreted by the pituitary gland, and therefore triggering the release of the egg from the ovary, that also is a fairly potent hormone and has other effects, so it might be having an effect on your GI symptoms. Because you mentioned undigested food in your GI tract, I would think about pancreas and stomach secretions of the various digestive juices as being impaired somehow by the LH surge. So my first thought would be, you're seeing undigested food, you're probably not chewing any differently than you do the rest of the month. So adding in digestive enzymes like a pancreatic enzyme formula and perhaps some hydrochloric acid like a betaine hydrochlorate, or if you want to be real natural about it, a quarter cup of apple cider vinegar with each meal, but essentially trying to acidify the stomach contents and then increase the amount of digestive enzymes that are present at the small intestine would be a good strategy and a good experiment to establish whether or not it's the secretion aspect that's being affected here. If it's not making a difference next month, then I would consider that you may be looking at a motility issue. In other words, the hormone surge causes increased motility of the intestines, causes things to move more quickly. And certainly probiotics as a therapy do have a normalizing effect on motility. And another thing that has a normalizing effect on motility is actually quote-unquote laxatives, by which I mean fiber laxatives like psyllium seed. These actually tend to normalize motility. If it's too fast, they slow it down. If it's too slow, they speed it up. So that might be an additional strategy. I want to caution you, go up slowly. If you do decide to do that, definitely go up slowly on your fiber. You want to be really careful about going too quickly because that can generate a lot of gas. We're going to go now to Jenny in Paso Robles. Hello, Jenny. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about my 5-year-old daughter. She grinds her teeth at night, and she's always complaining of headaches. And I was wondering, I'm thinking about maybe neurofeedback or acupuncture, and I was wondering if you had any information on those two options.
On the subject of acupuncture first, children respond really well to acupressure. You often don't even need to use needles in children because their energy is so great, so high, that it can be directed with less invasive modalities. There's also a group of people who do ear acupuncture where they don't use needles, they use a little electrical stimulator. Mm-hmm. And that's where probably I would start with a child, would be ear acupuncture at the jaw. If I were going to go that route, I would use ear acupuncture either with electrical stimulation or just with actually a little blunt stick. Have the acupuncturist mark the spot with a Sharpie on the ear and then just hit it with a blunt stick. And there's a couple of other acupuncture points that could be addressed that way. With children, that is often sufficient. conventional medical care would be a bite block so that she doesn't mess up her teeth or hurt her jaw. So the bite block is just a soft rubber appliance that you sort of chew on in your sleep. It's like running with bare feet on concrete versus wearing nice springy runny shoes on concrete. It really helps the joint be less injured and the muscles as well.
I'm wondering how I find a practitioner of ear acupressure.
Well, you would start with just, where are you?
Paso Robles.
Paso Robles. Well, I'd start with searching acupuncture Paso Robles and just doing a web search and see who's there and then contacting their offices and asking about pediatric experience, because there are a number of people who have gone through trainings that specifically qualify them to do more pediatrics. And as I've implied, acupuncture in pediatrics is a little bit different. Another good source is to go to the American Academy of Medical Acupuncture, and they are all MDs as well as acupuncturists. And most MDs who are acupuncturists have gotten ear acupuncture training. That's a cultural thing, just in the nature of how one gets trained in acupuncture in this country depends on what school you go to. But in Europe, almost all French physicians, primary care doctors, are trained in ear acupuncture. And that's partly just cultural. It's partly because ear acupuncture is the kind of short, rapid office visit sort of intervention that dovetails nicely with conventional medical practice. And so it's easy to incorporate. And because it keeps medical costs down, which has been a goal of the French government since, 1940 or so. So they've instituted a system where the number of primary care physicians is huge. And the ratio is about a third of ours. So I don't remember our primary care to patient ratio in this country, but in France, it's one third of that. So for every patient, there are three more primary care doctors. I'm saying that poorly, but I think you're getting my meaning. They do ear acupuncture as part of standard conventional medical therapy in France, and it's obviously as effective or they wouldn't keep doing it.
Right. Okay. Well, I will look into that.
That's how I would start, and the headaches are probably related to this. Are you clear what the stressors are in your child's life? Because
no.
All right. In that case, do some visualizations. And so at bedtime, do you do a bedtime story?
We usually read before bed.
Okay. So instead of reading before bed, get some visualization tapes or else get a book of nice visualizations and read that. So things like floating on the river, or flying with the birds, or nice imagery that's relaxing imagery so that the stress level is dropped just at bedtime. And that might be a good strategy. I do visualization work all the time in my adults with TMJ. I have them do visualization. I'll give them a hypnosis tape that is essentially the hypnotic induction that I did with them, but it also can be used just as a relaxation tape. And I find it very effective.
I'll try that.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we have Judith in Watsonville. Hello, Judith. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was interested in your comment about wanting a national standard of care, and I'm concerned that that would be set by the wrong interests.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new movie that's playing right now at the Nickelodeon called Under Our Skin, which one of the things it talks about is the problem in the treatment of Lyme disease, because the IDSA has set a standard of care which completely rules out chronic Lyme disease as, an infectious problem at all. And so...
What's the IDSA?
The Infectious Disease Society of America.
Oh, okay, yes. All right, so we're at that controversy.
So there's two standards of care. There's that, and then the ILADS standard of care.
Right.
And it talks very much about how the people that set those standards have interests in vaccines and in test kits and in certain things that make them want to set the standard of care in one way, so that a lot of patients just, they get the short end of the stick.
Okay, you make a very good point. I'm going to generalize it from Lyme disease, though, because that's just one of a number of issues, conditions that are framed in a way that is like, well, we have the establishment, which has all these special interests, and they do. There's no question about it. And we have the, the free thinkers who are dealing with this disease burden that isn't recognized by conventional medicine. And the reason I want to generalize that is because as we move to a national standard, to a national healthcare system, this is going to be a huge issue in that do alternative practitioners get to share in a single-payer system? Let's frame it that way. Obviously, now, in our current market-based system, the answer is no. It's a bait and switch. My experience with acupuncture is quite classic. I will never bill another insurance company for acupuncture because although they say that they pay for acupuncture, what they pay is what you might be able to buy an acupuncture treatment for in China right now. The rates of reimbursement are so low as to be impossible to make a living on. Literally, $20 for an hour's work is not something that any practitioner can do unless they're running a mill, which is the exact opposite of what people come to an acupuncturist for. They want individualized therapy. They don't want to be in a room with 12 other people with an acupuncturist walking from bed to bed, you know, twisting needles and then coming back around in 5 minutes to twist them some more. But that would be the only way to work with the under the insurance companies. So very few people actually take the insurance for a reason. And the insurance companies advertise that they have alternative funding, but then when it really comes push comes to shove, they really don't. It's a loss leader to get people to sign up, and then they discover that the benefit isn't there. So I'm pretty cynical on our current situation. So I don't know how much worse it could get under a single payer, but that's a personal commentary, and it begs the greater issue which you bring up, which is what about stuff that people believe they have, and they believe that there's a therapy, but that therapy is not generally recognized as safe or effective. And in the case of the standards for what the alternative group, the other Lyme's disease group, what was their initials?
It's in the International Lyme's and Associated Diseases Society.
Yeah, and when I, as a physician and a functional medicine doctor, I have to say, when I look at what is the standard of care that they're promoting, that care scares me because of the use of long-term IV antibiotics, for example, which I know to be very dangerous at a lot of other levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I become concerned about overdiagnosis and over-inclusion of people who have a symptom complex that is just, it's not really clear whether they have chronic Lyme or whether their antibodies are high because there's something wrong with their immune system. And so all of their antibodies are high. And I know that we may be misdiagnosing people with chronic Lyme disease because people want a name. You know, there's a great desire to put a name on my disease. Because you feel better, you know, when you go to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, there's nothing wrong with you, and you feel like crap, and you know there's something wrong with you, and you're dismissed, which is an experience people have constantly in our system, and I deeply regret that, then you seek out alternative practitioners, some of whom have a very strong financial interest to give you IV therapy, which is expensive and, you know, is very profitable. So it's not squeaky clean in either direction, and I do think that our best bet, and I say this with the understanding that this is still a flawed approach, but our best bet is to actually go to the people who don't have much of a financial interest, and that's the university academics. And what we'll find is that we'll have late adoption, but the data will eventually change the standards. We've seen that with things like ulcers, where now ulcers are treated with antibiotics, whereas that idea took 15 years to get traction. It happened during my tenure as a physician, so I watched it go from being an outlandish idea to, interesting hypothesis, to, well, now it's a standard of care. It does happen.
It seems like the academics in this case do also have economic interest, which is a problem.
I think you have to set up national committees that are squeaky clean, and these are people who don't have stock in a vaccine company, who really have to look at the data, and as the data changes and new data emerges, they revisit the data. I think the National Institute of Health does a pretty good job of this. I think within the province of infectious disease, I think the CDC does a pretty good job of this, and particularly NIH with the cancer work. I think they do a very good job as a clearinghouse and as looking at the studies and looking at the data and having a best practices web presence, but also just a resource that you can go to that gives you current best practices that is fluid. It's like a wiki. It does evolve. So I think we've got examples of how it's being done well, and I'd like to see those studied carefully for their salient features and have that become the way we approach advances in medicine. But I do think we have to be evidence-based. It's just the only way to go forward.
I think there's a lot of evidence out there that Lyme disease can become chronic. And that's just, the people who are setting the standards are just not looking at the evidence. It's not that the evidence is not out there. It's that they're picking and choosing which evidence they're looking at.
And if we go to a national system, right now there's absolutely no incentive on the part of anybody to acknowledge that chronic Lyme disease exists, because it will be, if it does exist, it's going to be very expensive to treat.
Uh-huh.
And so there are definitely things against it. But the fact is, it isn't as clear-cut as the H. pylori. It's very murky.
Well, and it's complicated by the fact that there's not only specifically Lyme disease, there's babesiosis, there's ehrlichiosis, there's Bartonella, there's a whole series of other, Mycoplasma, there's a whole series of other organisms that are in the same ticks that bite people that contain the specific organism that causes Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
And it seems like there's not good education in the current medical establishment about these things, even in the infectious disease community.
I can't comment on that. I don't know how good the infectious disease community is doing at educating itself about these so-called emerging diseases. It's been my experience that infectious disease doctors tend to be kind of research geeks and are definitely reading their literature all the time. So I don't know if maybe there's a problem with getting things published, because it's hard to prove it scientifically or set up a controlled situation, because these are hard to isolate one variable. I'm trying to be charitable here and say maybe there are reasons that are structural or intrinsic about the way these multiple diseases in one person work that make it hard for us to examine with our single variable, double blind kind of mentality. And certainly I run into that all the time with acupuncture. So, I do believe that could be possible.
Yeah.
Overall, what I would like to see is that the low-hanging fruit, and with all due respect to people who have a weird disease that is making them unhappy but not killing them, what I would like to do as a society is I would like to make sure that access to the really basic stuff like cancer surveillance and stroke prevention and diabetes prevention and early management and early intervention, the things that kill most of us, are addressed. And I'd like to see that be step one. And right now, we are doing such a lousy job of meeting these extremely basic needs. It's like food, housing, clean water, basic health care. Let's get the basic health care piece in place and then talk about how we're going to refine it. But if we get bogged down too much in whether or not we're even going to establish basic health care, I don't think that there's any hope for people with the odd diseases or the rare diseases.
Well, unfortunately, Lyme disease is an epidemic that's growing faster than the AIDS epidemic and going largely unrecognized. And the early treatment is key. And unfortunately, in this area, a lot of doctors say, oh, it's not here. So if somebody comes in asking for early treatment, they don't get it.
Okay, that may be the case. I think that I don't want to give antibiotics for 2 weeks to everybody who walks in my office with a tick bite. Mm-hmm. I just don't want to do that. My sincere belief is I'll be doing more harm than good. It's 21% of the ticks at Nicene Marks. That's the highest single local. If you average it out, it's 4% over the county. But if you go to the place where there are the most ticks, it's like 21% of the ticks they can isolate. Let me finish. Of those, I really believe the CDC I don't think they're lying when they tell me the tick has to be on there for a while, and that it's at the end of the blood meal when the tick regurgitates that the Lyme disease transmits. If that's wrong, and I can't believe the CDC, then I need you to prove to me that that's true. Currently, just let me finish and then I'll let you talk, I promise, okay? But currently, as a physician who's really tried to look at this and be honest with myself and look at the data and respect all of the, I'm certainly not, standard conventional medicine, you know that, but I really do try to look at the science and look at what I can find. And if the tick's on there for 24 hours, I will watch that person like a hawk or treat, depending upon the individual. But if they get a little fever or they get a little rash, they're getting their doxycycline. That's my best prudent course right now. Treating everybody, I'm going to do harm. And that's the first thing I tried not to do is no harm. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You're on.
Okay. I would just briefly want to say I really do appreciate the alternative aspect of you of your practice, and I look a lot to alternatives, and I think that's been really important in my own Lyme treatment also. Related to the tick attachment time, it's not at all clear to me that it really does take as long as the authorities say to transmit Lyme disease, but then there's the question of what about the transmission of all the other tick-borne diseases? Has there been, what studies is to prove that they take longer to transmit also? So that's a question, and the doxycycline also helps to treat those other things as well as Lyme disease, which is why it's usually the first antibiotic used.
Yeah.
And the other thing related to what you were saying is the percentage of ticks sort of countywide, in a study that I've seen. You said four, I've seen a little over five, but again, that's still low in a low range. But that's of the adult ticks, and as in California, there's a western fence lizard, which the nymphal ticks feed on, and so after they feed on it, they are no longer infected as adults. So the infection rate in nymphal ticks is likely to be 3 to 4 times higher than the adult ticks. So it's, countywide, it's likely to be up, 15 to perhaps over 20% or perhaps even higher in IC marks.
Okay, so I'm going to grant you that. What's your conclusion about that? Should I give antibiotics to everybody? Would be what you would want doctors to do?
Well, I think that might be, depending on, if for an Ixodes tick, I think that may well be the best thing, because it takes time to get the tick tested.
Sure.
And it takes time for in which the infection could spread.
Okay. So I will just say I'm going to concede all of those things. And I'm still going to tell you that you can make the same argument that I should give antibiotics to everyone with a sore throat, because some of those sore throats will be strep. And if a person has the wrong strep bacteria, they could have heart valve damage or kidney damage in a month or two. And so to prevent that, I should give antibiotics to everyone. And that was one of the older standard of care in medicine. We dropped that standard of care because we were hurting more people than we were helping. Antibiotics are not benign. And especially if a person is out there in the woods and they're getting ticks 3 or 4 times a year, and you decide you're going to treat all of those ticks every time,
mm-hmm.
you are going to so mess up that person's bowel flora, you're going to subject them to risks, real health risks from the antibiotics. Plus, you're going to run out of antibiotics in 10 years because you're going to create resistance. It's just, we have to really think carefully before we start a treat-all-comers kind of practice. And I think the moment it's bad medicine. We're very close to the end of the hour. I'm going to let you... I'm going to give you a wrap-up comment.
I guess just then sort of an alternative is, I understand that it's 7 weeks after a tick bite when the antibodies that I've heard from somebody that does these tests, perhaps to be sure and wait and do the test at the proper time. And then, if it comes positive to treat, that might be.
I think that's a really good compromise position. And do you have any references or published data on that delay for the antibodies?
Well, I'm not sure. I got that from Nick Harris at Igenix. What he, in a talk that he was giving, and that's a reference lab for tick-borne diseases.
All right. So I'd love to see that information, because I do think that's a nice, sensible compromise position until we know more. And that's great. We had a nice discussion here. We treated each other as grown-ups, and we came to a conclusion we could both agree with. I'm liking this.
Okay.
Perhaps we could model.
Okay.
Maybe we can model a process here.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call, Judith.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
We have just time maybe to do one quick email. This one from Mary in Beaufort, South Carolina. I love to do the ones from a distance. My husband has been diagnosed with vitiligo. I wondered if you had any information on new treatments. He's done light therapy, can't help but think it's related to his thyroid. So what do I think about vitiligo? I think vitiligo is an autoimmune disease that causes a loss of pigmentation. And the first thing I do when I see autoimmune disease at the moment is I check vitamin D levels, and I treat with supplements to get the vitamin D levels up to about 60 or 70 in anyone with an autoimmune disease. I'm basing this on an extrapolation from the multiple sclerosis research, MS also being an autoimmune disease, and the fact that I'm not worried about giving anybody a vitamin D level of 70. We know that's safe. So it definitely fits in the won't hurt, might help category. Hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.